While fintech has absolutely exploded over the last 5 years, the scope of the industry is just scratching the surface, at least according to today's guest. With the expansion of AI and the needs for people and companies to continue to spend more and spend smarter, it doesn't seem likely that the hypergrowth of the fintech sector will calm down anytime soon.
You're listening to Bound, the TechCrunch podcast that brings you the stories behind the startups. And today we're talking to Eric Lyman, the CEO and co-founder of Ramp, a spin management platform. I'm Dominic Widuri-Davis, and alongside me learning about how AI makes corporate finances easier is my wonderful co-host,
Becca Skutak. And today, before we bring in our guest, we're going to get into our two truths and a lie for this episode. So listen carefully, and as you go through the episode, take note of what you heard in the intro and try to figure out yourself which one was the lie. So the three things you're going to be listening out for is the lie that this is the second company Eric started with his current co-founder, is the lie that they got the idea for Ramp when working at Capital One, or is the lie that Eric grew up in Silicon Valley, which is what inspired him to become the founder he is today. You'll have to listen in on the conversation to figure out which one is true and which one is the lie. But before we dive into our conversation, just a quick little housekeeping note. Dear listeners, if you love Found and you have enjoyed listening to us coming into your ears every Tuesday, please take a second, if you can, to rate and review the show on whatever platform you listen to Found on. We greatly appreciate it. And we know you guys love the show. So drop us a little note and a little review if that makes sense. And without further ado, here's our conversation with Eric. Hey, Eric, how's it going?
Thanks for having me, Becca.
Well, thanks for coming on the show. I'm really excited for this one because on Found, as our listeners know, we do a whole range of different types of companies on the show. And I know today, obviously, we're talking to Eric from Ramp. And Ramp has been one that's been in the headlines a lot over the last few years. You guys are not a particularly old startup, but have kind of seen this huge ramp up period, pun fully intended. So I'm excited to dive in. So I think probably the best place to get started, in case some of our listeners are unfamiliar with you guys, is why don't you start by telling us a little bit about Ramp?
Yeah, for sure. So for Ramp, a lot of us know us for our corporate card and being the fastest growing in the US, but I think the right way to think about it is anything that a finance team needs to run the operations of a company, whether it's cards, expense management, bill payment, procurement, you know, in the process of buying things, we offer a platform that makes it easy and intuitive. We connect on both ends. So if you're hiring or if folks leaves the company, we can automatically tag expenses to the correct department and location. We link into accounting software. So at the end of the month, it's easy to make sure all your receipts are collected, all the approvals and proof of purchases are in one easy place, and your books are done. And the design of all of our products is intended to help companies spend less. And so today, for the average business that uses Ramp, they're able to save about 5% per year, which is much more than what any card program alone can do. So that's the high level, but happy to go a lot deeper.
And something I'm always curious about is because the concept of, you just mentioned a lot of different areas that Ramp exists in. I know something we complain about on the user side, I'm probably not the only person who hates expense reports, hates Concur, and hates that whole process. There's so much friction, and it seems like for no reason. And so I'm curious, what got you interested in this space to begin with? And if it was just that, you were just tired of using the software yourself.
It's a super good point. And I mean, I'll just state, like, probably obvious for most people, but it is crazy that to buy one thing, you need to log into two systems and integrate it into more, right? Someone needs to assign you a card. It has rules that don't talk with how your expense policy behaves. You then need to go in later the next day. Usually it hasn't, the transaction is ported over into Concur. So just very frustrating. And I think in a lot of engineering design, you know, the best part is no part, really simplifying systems guide a lot of our logic. And I think part of what's made Ramp so much easier is you tap your card, your expense policy dictates whether or not it gets approved. We can text you when the receipt is still in your hand. We can pull the receipt automatically from email, which a lot of merchants will go and send. And it's a zero touch purchase. We fell into it in a pretty, I would say, different way. The way that we got into Ramp actually started with our last business. It was called Paribus. TechCrunch actually covered it at Disrupt when we first launched back in 2015. But it was, I guess you'd call it an AI agent today, but back then it was just a savings app. It lived in your email. It would scan your inbox for receipts. So let's say you bought a TV at Best Buy for $1,000 and the next week it goes on sale for $900. All these stores guaranteed you could get the difference if you asked. And so it actually just wrote to the store on your behalf to get you the difference. You'd see $100 show up the next day and we charged a cut. So it was this sort of business model of aligning incentives with the customer. It grew really quickly. And within about a year, we had 1 million customers and we got a life-changing offer from Capital One to buy the company. And so we ended up spending the next few years thinking about how do you turn data into savings at scale, build products that actually help customers have a better financial life in some sense. They put us in the credit card division. They didn't quite know what to do with us. And we saw this profitable industry that hadn't changed in many years, kind of as the world went from no phones to flip phones to iPhones, to your point. Concur never changed. Your credit card never changed. Your bank account never really changed. And not only had it not evolved, but things were very misaligned. There were a lot of really smart people there thinking about how to get customers to spend more, and some thinking about how do we make people think the points are worth more and devalue it in the background. We talked to customers and asked them, did you want points, cash back, something different? And usually people would say, you know, I actually just wanted more of my bank account, you know, please. And the best way to do that was helping people not spend a dollar in the first place on something they didn't need or weren't using was 100 times better than getting 1% back on that purchase. And so that took us after a few years to get obsessed with this idea of what if there was a card and software that was both designed to help people spend less money and really to the prompt of the question, to spend less time. And I think what jumped out to us was if you really cared about helping people spend less time, you wouldn't have two systems to buy one thing. It would be one. You wouldn't have to integrate it to have a different bill payment software and have different procurement software. You would start to combine this and try to figure out how to remove steps from every part of the process.
And what's so interesting about this is that your first startup was definitely consumer focused, consumers getting price changes. I know I used to work at Anthropology and I would do quite many price changes at the register. And thinking about how Ramp is obviously focused more on the B2B side or B2B2C, obviously people who work at these companies or who use these underlying products. How much of a switch was it for you guys to think about this kind of a problem with that B2B element? Or is it not as different from tackling a consumer-focused product looking to save money as well?
I love it. My first job was at Express.
I saw on your LinkedIn. I love that you still have it on there.
Yeah. Selling t-shirts and jeans, I think, is a good it's a good thing. You learn how to work with people. But I think it's a really good question. So I actually want to, I think, and you learn there's a lot of universal. There is something as good design, good taste, all of that. And I think what's been very bizarre once we started getting into the B2B space was at home, people would use extremely well-designed apps, Spotify, Instagram, people are buying Nike shoes. Like, you know, good design is in lots of places. And then you open Concur and you're like, what happened?
You know,
you're in these clunky things. And so part of what I would say stuck with us in moving into the B2B space was like, there should be great design. We should be very clear on what is the value that we're providing to customers. Every product we create has to help people spend less and tie back to that. I think that sort of design-oriented, user-oriented form of building is something we've tried to embrace, but I think many more companies are starting to bring into work. So that's stuck with us. I think things that were different was how much more complicated decision-making is. And my kind of comparison point for this is like, imagine if you had to share a card with 20 family members, you know, parents, grandparents, cousins, all that.
Oh,
like, you'd probably end up with like multiple Spotify subscriptions, Netflix, people would buy all sorts of things. Like companies are maybe a little more organized, but kind of like that. There's some kind of shared mission, but before you know it, like people are spending on things you wouldn't expect. Things get a little bit, you know, out of control. And when we were starting to think about what's the right place to start, if you really wanted to help people save, businesses often are much more inefficient than just people managing their own expenses. And so it was both a place where we thought we could break design, we thought we could do a lot, and then last, in the context of building a fintech product, much simpler to build. Of course, there's regulations and things that we want to be thoughtful of, but really the barrier to entry in the consumer landscape is so high that we wanted to start really with business where we could make an impact right away.
One thing, so I think it's really interesting that your last company was also a fintech and this one is a fintech. Is this just a space that you're just really, really interested in? Or you see that, like, is innovation slow or fast when it comes to, I guess, financial services?
I think it's going to get a lot faster, but I believe it was super slow most of the past 30, 40 years, which is like, it's very bizarre. Like, I actually think up until really a decade ago in many ways, you know, if you were a bank, you were allowed to move money or store money. And if you weren't, sorry, you know, you could sell software to these people. And I think that's a big part of why, as the rest of the world really innovative, people's expectations of their financial products were very, very low. And there was aftermarket products really built on top of it. I think what changed, some of it was regulation coming out of Dodd-Frank and the financial crisis, but some of it was just, you know, you could start a company within 45 days, be live on Visa and issuing cards out to customers was, you know, the barriers to entry wasn't you needed to be a mega cap company approved by bank regulators, but you know, even hackers, people with different ideas, product kind of minds could start building products and sort of compete in a way that was off limits before. So that, I think, is all to say, there was a lot of low-hanging fruit where if you could build a product, you could actually add a lot more value and compete with people that weren't used to being competed with, is some of how we think about it. I think that the other part, and in some sense, Ramp is a bit of a confusing one to people because on the face of it, we look like a fintech company. We move money. We think about that a lot. But I actually believe we're primarily a productivity company. We're trying to answer the question of how do you help people get more out of every hour and every dollar? And the value of it isn't you've got a card or you can make a bill payment or you can move money from one account to another. You know, the value is you can buy what you need and it meets your expense policy. You know, the receipts are collected automatically. Your books are done for you. You can see a software vendor says it's $200 per month and you can see what did the rest of the network pay and see discounts that you can access by, you know, sort of seeing real live data. And so a lot of really the questions that we're trying to answer is not how do you move money, but how do you take finance, which has historically been very tedious and monotonous. You know, there's a lot of repeated work, a lot of looking for spreadsheets, a lot of downloading and uploading things. And how do you automate that to make it strategic, insightful, and more purposeful? So it's an interesting category that not a lot of companies have thought about, I really think.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about the automation process and most specifically like AI and how using AI to build these types of companies has evolved since you first entered the fintech space. So I would love to hear about how you used AI for your first company and like how it's changed or how you're using it now.
Yeah. It has come such a long way. I mean, back in 2015, about a decade ago, when we were working on Peribus, it was very kind of simple heuristics. What we were really doing is taking vast amounts of email traffic that was coming through, and we wanted to make sure we were doing it in a privacy-centric way, so only kind of pulling receipt-level data. And then you take this unstructured information, however someone emailing you decides to format the message, and start to structure it to find patterns and be able to draw strings of text and put into a database. This is the product. This is what was paid on this date. We're going to check that product the next few days and see if it changes prices. So some of it was simple scripts. Where it started to get interesting was on two sides, both the writing of email. We would use, you know, natural language processing, both on the generation of text based on the context, what was written, writing lots of different formats of notes because we were sending it on people's behalf. We didn't want to send the same thing every time. We wanted it to look authentically as a customer. And so it was some very simple generative AI to put together language constructions and interact with customer service on the other side. And then when the response came back, we were dealing with, at scale, thousands and thousands of responses per day, you know, rebates, and a very small team. And so it was automation and AI to both detect the nature, whether it was successful, what was the emotion of the response, whether it was a positive, negative, what was the amount of the refund so that we could charge a cut. And so a lot of it was simple machine learning on pattern matching and structuring into data and kind of early generative use cases around it. Today, it is radically further. And so you'll see some similar use cases around like machine learning in order to kind of predict the likelihood and take fields to detect, okay, this is a receipt, which is an image, or the Ramp infrastructure has no context about what it is. Break it down and figure out which transaction should this match to, what's the amount, and making sure we do that at high accuracy. Expense intelligence. I think one of the most annoying parts sometimes for many people in turning in expenses, you get a flag and say, was this alcohol? And you say, no, this was a shrimp cocktail. That was, you know, at dinner, not an old-fashioned or an alcoholic cocktail. And so, you know, we built in heuristics to kind of detect and automatically flag when it's relevant, not flag it when it's not. And so there's a lot that you'll see there. I think some of the more interesting applications that are starting to be really relevant is large language models. That was something that back in 2015-16 was really in the academic research phase. Today, we're able to do things like when we get a memo from someone on the sales team says, you know, lunch with customer X, we're able to translate that from how people naturally talk, not force them to go into a drop-down menu, pick what's your accounting and general ledger category to, you know, translating hearing salesperson speak, employee speak to, you know, how it should look in your books and records and suggest categories at a higher degree of accuracy than accountants would be able to do, even if they were fully going through. There's an error rate that tends to be there and doing it in a lot less time. And so there's a lot of cases around that. A lot of the other cases that I think are very interesting, so we can go deep in the product side, but I would say, especially for startup founders and people building out there, I think the nature of how work is getting done is just shifting. Part of how we help train and make sure and learn from both wins and losses. When we win sales conversations and lose, is we record every sales conversation. And so we've amassed kind of tens of thousands of calls that we've kind of trained our own team and learn on. You can apply large language models to it and overnight get the voice of a customer and ask, you know, hey, why do customers pick Ramp versus competitor X? And it can all at once listen to 50,000 calls, pull out examples of sort of win reasons and what customers say in their own voices so we can write better marketing copy. Our engineers, everyone uses functionally GitHub Copilot, allows us to complete code faster and work to even our outreach and how we grow. We've introduced a lot of automation to write more personalized and accurate notes. And so it's really profound. I would say, I think a decade ago, you would use it in hyper-targeted use cases to today. I don't think there's a part of Ramp that isn't affected in some way by AI, and I think it's going to keep accelerating.
And sort of a follow-up to that, I know especially in categories like fintech and healthcare, there's always this sort of but at the end of the sentence, like we're AI-enabled, but you can't take the human fully out of the process, or we're in an AI-enabled, but we still need human oversight in this area or that. And it seems particularly big, like I said, in categories like healthcare, fintech, because there is so much weight carrying on it. Of course, a business wouldn't want to find out an AI had messed up and now they're losing money because something just like wasn't caught. And so I'm definitely curious what your thoughts are on that sort of ongoing discourse in the industry about how much can you automate these things using AI and when do you still need people in the loop?
It's a great question. And I would still say in many, many aspects, you really do want people. What I would say is like already at scale, and this is not Ramp specific, but most credit underwriting decisions, truly for most credit cards, can be better done by large statistical models and machine learning models. And I think happen for almost a decade. So when you're looking at broad sets of data, hundreds of different variables that can predict whether or not this is a good credit risk, you take sort of the old human models of, okay, if this person has above an 800 credit score, they get a card. If it's below 800, they don't. It's far inferior to outcomes that might say the credit score actually of 750 or of 600 actually works well with these shapes if we're going to adjust limits or we're going to kind of grow this. And I think actually machines in some ways are actually to create a lot of value, create more access by taking into a lot more patterns. And so I think there's positive use cases and ones where statistically, you know, that's already there today. Where I think it gets very interesting and actually you do really want, you know, people in the loop and oversight is particularly on cases where it's more custom fit to hyper-specific workflows that I think need oversight and monitoring and training. So that's one way that I start to think about it. There's a lot of work that people are doing that is actually not, in my view, like the best place for people to work. And to be more specific, like it is really thankless for people to have to go and like chase down really people who really understand finance and accounting to have to go chase down and say like, where are the receipts? Let me download the spreadsheet and upload it here. And every month I'm going to go through 1,000 rows and I'm going to click this button. I'm going to make these rules and I'm going to check it. There's a lot of just like tedious pattern matching that actually, if you look at how most finance teams run, it's typically somewhere of 50 to 70% of work teams is just like rote work. And I think it actually, the cost of that is it prevents people from asking questions like, how do we grow faster? Having the time to talk with customers, having the time to build and work on new products or better scalable processes. And I think that where agents are starting to get deployed into more use cases and ones is where, you know, it's lower risk. You know, it's not the large strategic questions of how should businesses operate, but it's actually the simpler ones. If we have these processes, how do we use automation so that we can give our team time back? You can check the work and the accuracy, but is starting to supervise on particular use cases. And so you can imagine use cases of, you know, simple agents to be your kind of accounting sidekick or your accounting agent, where it's suggesting, it's taking the first run through, it's giving you, you know, its estimates and accuracy and methodology. And just like you would with someone earlier and starting out, you would check the work, you would kind of give feedback and progressively create more trust and ability to take those processes off your shelf. I think over time, this is a good thing. I think it allows people to do the interesting work, the adding, thinking through the stories versus the kind of the tedium. But I think it requires iteration on it, is why I think this is actually going to be a very constant conversation for the next decade.
More from this conversation right after a quick break.
And how do you and Ramp go about addressing cybersecurity?
Yeah.
Because I'm just thinking, you're dealing with like accounting, AI. How do you go about addressing it?
Yeah, it's like, I mean, look, at its core, our business is based on trust, you know, in two ways. First, if you're going to run your business on cards of payments, you need surety that that payment is going to go through. Vendors aren't going to be paid late. You know, when you need it, we're going to be there. Next is our role. I think what set Ramp apart is we actually measure ourselves with how much money and how much time have we saved people. And we report out on that. And so I think at the heart of both just the basics, the foundations of how we work to even people's willingness and interest in working with Ramp versus any other card, it has to do with, do you believe that Ramp is on your side and have we demonstrated that to you? So one, you know, it's actually like probably the first thing that we think about. Where I think it starts to get interesting is when you think about kind of designing for modern cybersecurity, you know, risk aversion. A lot of how we've endeavored to build this is isolation of risk so that where certain data is sitting is isolated, doesn't touch other broad sets of data. For payments data, we're thinking about PCI compliance to make sure that for sensitive information that if you had it, you could actually move money from account to account is the most locked down. To even the partition in a way that data is stored, you know, a lot of how we've designed our own architecture is not in kind of the old way where it's in servers. If you break into one, you can get a broad set of access. Things are really partitioned out such that very few folks have access to make any particular change. That access is very narrow and maybe only would last for a period of seconds versus broad-based. And so it's something that we think about a lot. Could probably do a whole episode on sort of thinking through how we're sort of taking both payment instruments, how we govern data, how we allow access privilege to even data that's sent between Ramp and end customers. Fairly intensive, but probably worth a deep dive. There's certainly hacking risk factors. There's a lot of fraud risk factors that come into play for financial service and fintech-oriented companies. You try to design processes to be ahead of both, you know, prevent transaction fraud. You see fraud, how do you detect it, stop it quickly? When you see these patterns, you're not detecting it 20 minutes later, but within 5 seconds and, you know, applying more one-shot learning to detect it quicker. There's fraud protections, there's credit loss protections, but it's actually a pretty large part and an extra onus that money moving businesses need to think through.
And switching gears a little bit, I know we talked earlier about how what it was like building Ramp versus building your previous company because of how much AI has changed. But I also want to talk a little bit more about that as far as just how much the venture market has changed. Thinking about you guys got started about 5 years ago, 2019. Obviously, we've seen a crazy period for venture over the last 5 years. All of the money from 2021, the hard fall in 2022, but also COVID at the same time versus the first time you were building the company around. That's what now everyone's referring to as the normal venture time. So what has it been like building these two different companies during such different markets, despite it's just not being that far apart time-wise?
It, I think, has changed a lot and been surreal. I mean, you know, my first startup, you know, we had never seen it before. Our business plan was we had worked for a couple of years. We had enough savings to last 4 or 5 months. And then we were out and grew some mustaches and moved to Williamsburg and just tried to make something work. I think all time Paribus had raised $2 million, something like that. And it was, I think, extremely challenging all the way through to the second time. Some of it, I think the times had changed. I think there were two sets of things that really changed. First, the number of businesses that had gone from starting to in 2021 becoming a great outcome could be worth tens of millions of dollars to hundreds to maybe there would be a couple businesses that would be worth a billion. By the time 2021 came around, you saw this increasing cycle of the exits weren't $30 million. They weren't 300, but there were suddenly startups that were legitimately worth $1 billion, $10 billion, $100 billion. And so it increased the appetite for investors to bet bigger in a way that they really simply didn't think about earlier. Next, I think there was a lot more education around how to start these types of companies. There's a lot of counterintuitive things with it. When a company is doubling every 6 months, it basically means every 6 months, whatever you did 6 months ago only gets you half as far. And 6 months later, it'll only be a quarter. And 6 months later. And I think just the education of what these companies look like, not just being hidden in these networks of you had to be in the Valley and no VCs or work at like Facebook in order to know this. But I think folks like Y Combinator and others democratizing deep dives into aspects of building the business increased. And so entrepreneurs were able to figure out and learn faster. It wasn't so tribal. So people were legitimately, the outcome firms were bigger, people were building businesses faster. And then last, which I think took things sort of out of control, was the cost of capital dropped to like 5 basis points, functionally 0%. And when you sort of think about how businesses are valued, often investors is it's a best guess of what's the sum of all profits today and in the future, and then how do we add them together to figure out what this business could be worth. Now, when a business is growing really quickly and the cost of capital is zero, mathematically, it basically implies that $5 million in profit today and $5 million in profit in 10 years from now are worth a similar amount. And if you're growing really quickly, it's not totally crazy to say, wow, in 10 years from now, this company is going to be doing $500 million in profit in 10 years. And you kind of can start to see where this is going. If you, in the old world, the cost of capital is high, $500 million in profit in the future might be worth $50 million in profit today, risk adjusted.
Right.
And so basically what it allowed people to do in their spreadsheet is to say, well, I'm going to add the 5 and the 10 and the 500, and it's worth 10x, you know, 20x what it was in kind of the high interest rate environment. So valuations got really out of whack during that period. I think why people are saying that the venture market now is more normal is interest rates are kind of in the context of historical norms. And so valuations, the amount of capital people put, is more normal. But I actually think that the success rate of entrepreneurs and people building companies is faster and is higher than it's what it's been in the past. So that's been the experience that I've seen out there. And the last thing that I'd say, Capital One is lucky to learn from Rich Fairbank, who the founder and CEO of Capital One is still there. For them to start, they had to convince the bank to let them work inside of it. They got a huge division together and spun it out and had to give away almost all the company. And it took years before they were able to kind of issue credit cards at scale. Ramp was able to issue its first card to customers within like a month and a half. And so there's better tools to create software. People kind of understand how to grow things faster. The willingness of investors to kind of go behind all increase. And so all these things put together is a big part of why I think people are building. And I think why people are, you know, to give a shout out, I think so interested in what's coming out of TechCrunch and Found and programs like this. I really think so.
And I do want to ask about sort of the decision behind launching the second business as well. Because I know it sounds like when you guys were at Capital One, you sort of became obsessed with this idea. And I know that is obviously such a big piece of it. But you founded Ramp with the same person you founded your last company with. Why did you guys know the timing was right? And why do you guys work so well together? Like, why would you credit wanting to jump in with the same person again?
So Kareem and I and Gene, we're all very different people. And I think when you're in high pressure situations, you start to see people's true colors come out. And we went through a lot of those, you know, we almost ran out of money. There was visa complications that Kareem went through, stresses of all types. I tend to kind of be more calm by nature, you know, trying to think of like, all right, if things go right, what could it look like? Try to plan for kind of like longer term stuff, just structurally, what might be interesting, aligned businesses. Kareem is brilliant. He actually taught me computer science in college. I've known him for a lot of years. And, you know, he grew up in Beirut, Lebanon, which I think over the course of his life was a really pretty dangerous place where often was sort of in civil conflict or war and things breaking out. And his mind tends to go to, you know, what if things go wrong? And be sort of, you know, when things are really good, he's stressed out because there might be things we're missing. And if things are bad, he gets really focused. And those two personalities together, I think, help us get the best out of each other. Sometimes he's more stressed than he should be. Sometimes I think, missing things that are actually really urgent. And I think in building a company for a long term, it's hard to have both in your head, to both be like optimistic and cynical at the same time. I think that combination tends to help bring out the best of each other. And so I really wanted to work with him again. And I also think too, on kind of great teams, you kind of learn to trust each other, to figure out what each other are great at. And that helped when we started. But, you know, I think as time has gone on, I think the reason Ramp has worked is had less and less and less to do with Kareem and I and Gene, but more have to do with, I think, just the incredible skill sets of people that we brought into the company. I think all of us at Ramp have an appreciation, a desire to find people who are amazing potential, not hiring for experience, but hiring for people who have done great things in their past, curious, passionate, and, you know, have a high slope kind of potential. And so those are the types of things that we look for. But it's fun to work with people you care a lot about and trust and, you know, enjoy trying to work with, because there's definitely good and bad days.
And to dive a little bit more into yourself, growing up, did you always want to be an entrepreneur?
So I was born and raised in Las Vegas, which it was sort of a fascinating place. Like, I'm in my early 30s now, but when I was born there, I think there was like 500,000 people, something like that. And 18 years later, there was 2 million. Now it's 3 million. It's a lot of things that make Vegas very strange, you know, and sort of a weird childhood. But like, what was great about it was like, they were always building new parts of town. And that was just what people did. And you could actually sort of meet people who built buildings, who were starting companies, who were trying new things out. It was kind of the norm. And I didn't really realize how unusual that was until I went to college, you know, on the East Coast. And it felt like things were stopped in time. There were buildings that were hundreds of years there. And you know, kind of the norm of this is a world you find your place in, it was kind of how a lot of people saw it. And so I guess it's to say, I don't know that I was always thinking about growing up of, I really want to be an entrepreneur and do that. It was just something that people did. I feel really lucky that I had that example around me for sure.
And I know we only have time for about one more question. So I do want to kind of look at what's next for you guys. I know you guys started out in a specific category and you guys have expanded a lot over the last few years. And some of those categories have more competitors, some have less. And it's sort of a different landscape based on like what area you guys are looking into, whether that's payments or expenses and the like. So what is next for you guys? How do you think about scale looking at it through that lens?
Yeah. So this has just been such an uninnovative industry for so long that as quickly as we've grown, we in our largest market of cards, we still have 99% plus of the market to go. And so some of this is actually just, we want to bring the magic to more companies of expenses can be effortless. Accounting can be radically simpler. And so there's a large element of just scaling and helping more companies of more shapes and sizes around the country and around the globe is one big, big part of it. So general growth. Next, as we've covered more and more in almost all the ways that companies can move money, we're really thinking about the cracks and things in between of not just how do companies move money, but what makes it so painful? Why is it that when companies get larger, it becomes awful? Like you can't buy software that is obviously better. It takes a month and lots of approvals. How do you condense that timing? How do you show companies that when they want to buy, and when someone recommends something that they know they can get the best rate automatically, that it's used by other great companies and it gets approved right away? This sort of takes us into areas that are often thought about less, like procurement, like bill payments, but even to making the travel experience all that much better are some of the functional areas. Where I think it gets most interesting and I get most excited about is the potential for agents and having Ramp turn into companies' savings agent and finance agent. And what I mean by that is back to even the roots of Paribus, a decade ago, millions of people had an agent that lived in their inbox that had a very specific use case, which was if you bought something and there was a better rate available, the product got shipped to you late, your Paribus agent basically wrote to customer support and got to the difference. It's 2024 and the ability for that kind of software to come alive, to give leverage to companies, big or small, to close their books faster, to understand and negotiate better rates, to have, you know, the benefit of what if everyone had like a personal assistant to whether it's make purchases, book travel or transactions, or just take care of work. That's what we envision. And if we do it right, I think and hope that work will feel purposeful, never tedious, monotonous, but strategic, insightful, and actually be able to focus on the high leverage and creative stuff. So that's what we're trying to work on. And it's been a lot of fun getting there.
Definitely. Thanks so much again, Eric, for coming on the show. This has been fun.
Thanks, Becca. Thanks, Tom.
And that was our conversation with Eric. And before we dive into our usual outro banter, we of course have to tell you what was the lie. Maybe you already know, maybe you're still not sure, but the lie was that Eric grew up in Silicon Valley. He is actually from Vegas, which I think is a great segue to talk about something he mentioned that I thought was particularly interesting. He mentioned that what did inspire him to be a founder was being from Vegas and seeing how much the city grew and scaled at the time he was growing up, which is very interesting to me. And I'm curious what you thought about that, Dom, as being the growth of the city he was living in, as being sort of this inspiration to end up wanting to do something within innovation yourself.
Yeah, I guess that's one way to find inspiration. Yeah, I've never thought about it. I don't know much about Vegas. When he was talking about it, I was like, yeah, I guess when I think of Vegas, I just think of that one little strip, I guess, with all the hotels.
Yeah.
I guess when you're growing up there, seeing a city like that develop over time with new industrialization and like new developments and everything, I guess it could inspire you. I feel like I don't have enough historical knowledge about Vegas to see, but it makes sense.
Yeah. I think I'm just like, I don't have the context for this because the town I grew up in, the only thing that's different about it now, which in fairness, this was huge news when this happened, was that they opened one restaurant in the downtown. That's the growth of the town I'm from in the span, the 18 years I lived there. So I have like no concept of this.
I know. I'm also from a small town. I'm like, I don't know what growth is, but shout out to cities that grow.
But I mean, it's a good thing it did inspire him. I mean, because this isn't even his first company. Like, he's gone on to found two companies within the fintech space, which I thought that was really interesting because, sure, like, we think of fintech as a category, but the fact that the first company was consumer and the second company is B2B focused, and the same time, like, the different markets he was building them in, like, these companies were just not that far apart in the grand scheme of things, like, less than a decade apart. And to think of how different all of that was, how much like change in the ecosystem there has been in that short time, is really interesting to think about how you would tackle it again.
Yeah, I like that he was doubling down on this sector and this industry and kind of finding new ways to address really old problems or address frustrations. Yeah, I really like that he was doubling down on the issue because both companies make a lot of sense and are very useful and practical. Yeah, because I'm trying to think about, and I guess I asked him this, but when it comes to financial innovation, like fintech is obviously a really big sector now, but it also seems like financial services as a whole is also slow at the same time. Like, it's like slow but fast.
No, that's what is so weird. I feel like I read about fintech, I mean, every day. Like, our coworker, especially like Marianne Azevedo, like, does so much great coverage on the fintech space. And then it's like, I look at my own personal thing and it's like, I go to one of the big banks. I'm not going to name them, but one of the big ones, everyone knows them, big national bank. I don't use like any fintech products. We go to work. Our expense system is Concur. It's like so crazy. And he's not the first person to say this. I know the Stripe, their big letter came out this week too and implied similarly, where it's like, we've grown this much, but we really are just not scratching the surface. Still, that's always just such a crazy concept for me to wrap my head around.
I know. I wonder what's happening. Is it like old guard versus new guard? Like, what's going on? Because yeah,
it's big bank.
It's big bank. Because I also just use a big bank. And I mean, I love reading about fintech. But now that I think about it, I don't really use many other apps that aren't associated with the big banks.
Yeah.
What is that about? What's going on?
That's why I've always been like interested in this category, particularly. Not to say it doesn't pass the vibe check, because that's not it. But like, especially with like the rise of neobanks and stuff. And I was like, I don't know. I feel like I would at least know one person, or at least know one person who knows one person who uses one of these. And I don't.
I know.
I just don't. I mean, like, I hope people adopt this stuff. I mean, if you're going to make corporate cards better. Not that I really have any complaints with the corporate card we use here, but like, if anything that's going to make expenses better, like, please fund it, grow it, let our company adopt it, please.
I was like, this is so brilliant. Our lives would be so much easier if we did have a product like this. Not you shouting out Concur in the actual podcast. I was like, oh my gosh, we're throwing hands and just naming Concur. Oh my gosh.
I was just going to say, we had Brex on last year and it was Daryl and I were like bad about it. I feel like we spent like 90% of the conversation just being like, so do you just hate Concur? And Henrique, the founder, was like, no.
Well, but you know, it is interesting. I loved hearing about the evolution of AI and seeing how he was able to use it for his first company. And now how much the industry has grown that he's able to do so much more with it for Ramp now.
Yeah. It's so interesting. Like, we have all these big conversations about AI and like what it'll mean for movies and like entertainment and like stuff like that. And then you see it applied in a place like this where it's like, okay, well, we're making these financial things that no one wants to do quicker, easier, automated, which makes everyone's lives easier. And I'm just like, oh, what a perfect use case for AI. Like, something that actually, you know, it's not like anyone's losing their job or anyone is like concerned about like how ethical something is because of AI. It's like, no, just like AI automates it, makes it easier. That sounds so simple, but so many of the things people are building in AI aren't doing that.
Exactly.
Yeah.
No, this is the perfect job for a robot. I think this is it. This is exactly what the AI robots should be doing. Automating stuff like this.
Yeah. Fix my expenses, please.
Practical use cases, please.
Found is hosted by myself, TechCrunch senior reporter Becca Skutak, alongside senior reporter Dominic Midori-Davis. Found is produced by Maggie Stamets with editing by Kel. Our illustrator is Bryce Durbin. Found's audience development and social media is managed by Morgan Little, Alyssa Stringer, and Natalie Kreisman. TechCrunch's audio products are managed by Henry Pickovit. Thanks for listening, and we'll be back next week.